Good morning. Good to be together. Maybe turn to your neighbor and say, "Your presence is my blessing." The young ones are a blessing, and so I'm going to do them a favor and dismiss them, release them. So let me go ahead and, children, you are dismissed, released, free to go. For the rest of us this morning, we are heading back to the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, what are considered to be the most significant teachings of Jesus. And today we come to Matthew 5 and verse 21. If you're grabbing a pew Bible, 684, which should get some delight out of you. We're no longer on 683, but we've turned the page to 684. We are moving along. The words will be on the screen behind me as well. So let's go ahead and read the text, and then we'll pray, and then we'll get after it. Get to work. Matthew 5:21, we're reading through verse 26. Jesus is continuing to speak here to his disciples, his Talmudim, his followers. Jesus, as we read, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Rakah,' is answerable to the court, and anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore," verse 23, "if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny." Let's pause and pray. God, we thank you for, as always, for the gift of your words, these words from Jesus, words that we believe are still living and active even today. And so as we consider them this morning, God, we would ask that you would open our hearts, that we might receive your truth, renew our devotion, that we might follow you more faithfully. And as always, may your words move us, mold us, shape us, draw us closer to you and to one another. It's in your precious name we pray. Amen. So, before we get into the text, I want to do a little bit of the backdrop. Kind of get into a little bit of the landscape, the context here. Keeping in mind that Jesus, this is in the first century, right, in the days of Jesus. And at this particular time, there are quite a number of different Jewish groups. Each one somewhat different and unique from the others. By way of example, we have this group called the Zealots. The Zealots are a radical, militant group. They fiercely oppose the Roman Empire, and they enter into open revolt often. Upon the death of their leader, kind of their founder, they head mostly into the desert, into the wilderness, where they turn to more guerrilla-type warfare tactics, still opposing, still resisting the Romans. Juxtaposed against the Zealots, we have the Essenes, who are a kind of a quasi-monastic community. They have also retreated from into the wilderness. We believe that the Qumran caves that we get the Dead Sea Scrolls from, that we believe the Essenes were part of that community. And so they've withdrawn, kind of a monastic community. They're very intent on the study of the Tanakh, the Old Testament to you and me. They lean toward mysticism. They focus on ritual purity. Along with that group, you also have the Sadducees. The Sadducees are a more aristocratic, kind of priestly group. They are very involved, significant in the temple. In fact, following the decimation of the temple in the year 70, they largely ceased to exist. They were intertwined with the temple and with the Sanhedrin. They were politically aligned with Rome, mostly as a means to maintain their power and their prestige. They were well off. This would be, we would think of maybe as the upper class. And then, of course, we have the Pharisees. The Pharisees were popular among the general population. They were a highly influential group. They were known for their devotion and dedication to the Torah. Not only to the written Torah, right, the first five books of our Bibles and the 613 mitzvot that are found there, but also very much dedicated to the oral Torah with its thousands upon thousands of rules and laws and regulations. Now, in addition to that, and I mentioned this last time, 2 weeks ago, that it was in 586 BC that the southern kingdom of Judah was defeated by the Babylonians. In 722, sometime 150 years before that, in 722, it was the northern kingdom, was defeated by Assyria. And so here in 586, for the most part, the Jewish people have been exiled, creating what the scholar Peter Berkowitz, he notes that it created this intense yearning for, we could say, or he says, restoration, right? This is understandable, he writes, in light of the fact that the exilic period brought not only an end to the dynasty and deportation to a distant land, but the loss of their sovereignty. And so now what you have is really deep in the ancient kind of Jewish psyche, right? Central to this intense yearning for restoration is this profound hope, this deep longing for the coming of the Messiah. And it travels all the way back. We saw this 2 weeks ago, all the way back to David, to the line of David, that God's covenant with David, a Messiah who would usher in and reestablish God's kingdom. 2 weeks ago, again, the historian Josephus, we read this, in the midst of the Roman Empire, first century, what most stirred them, meaning the Jewish people, up to war, was an ambiguous oracle that was found also in their sacred writings, that about that time, one from their country should become ruler of the world. Now with that, stay with me here, with that you have a number of different views and ideas and opinions about how that would come about, how and when that would come about, and you had some who believed that there was a specific moment in time, that God had ordained a specific day, a specific time, when the coming of the Messiah, when the Messiah would appear. Others based it on the behavior and the actions of Israel. And this is where the Pharisees then come back in and enter the scene, noting that they believed that the way to usher in the kingdom was to keep the Torah, was to do, was to obey the Torah. And they had this phrase or this saying that if all Israel would keep the Torah perfectly for just one day, the Messiah would come. It's from the scholar Sanders, Edinburgh Philip Sanders. He writes, the Pharisees' conception of religion was the belief that the Babylonian exile, so we're back at 586 BC, the fall of the southern kingdom, belief that the Babylonian exile was caused by Israel's failure to keep the Torah, and here meaning the written Torah, the 613 mitzvot, and that its keeping was an individual as well as a national duty. And so what happens is the Pharisees begin to build what we could think of as a fence. Build a fence around, creating boundaries around. This fence is the oral Torah, with its thousands upon thousands of laws and rules, regulations, what is often described as oral tradition. And so they began to build this fence, right, to keep people from breaking the written Torah, right, so that Messiah would come. If they can do this for one day perfectly, then Messiah would come. And so I'm going to put this fence around, this boundary around, to keep people from breaking the written Torah. And I'm going to set it up in such a way that, you know, that you can't even come really close, right? We're going to set up this big boundary. By way of example, in Exodus 23 and 19, this is from the written Torah, right? Do not cook a goat in its mother's milk. And so the Pharisees looked at this, and in some respects, we all do this, right? Every time we read scripture, we're doing some interpretation, right? We're taking in, and how does this apply? And so that's some of what the Pharisees are doing here. But we have, do not cook a young goat in its mother's milk. And so that we don't accidentally do this, right? Keep in mind here, we have a young goat, that's meat. We have its mother's milk, and so we have meat and milk. And so found today in the Mishnah, which is the written compilation of that oral Torah, we read there, one may not eat meat and milk together, even if they were not cooked together. And so we have milk and meat, so how can we put this fence around? One must wait a certain amount of time between eating meat and milk. Two acquaintances may not share a table if one is eating dairy products and the other is eating meat products. And this kind of thing goes on and on. And there's an aspect of this that there's a good intent, right? This isn't bad. This isn't wrong, so to speak, right? We're trying to set up this kind of fence. The problem is that pretty soon you're down that rabbit hole. You're down that rabbit trail. And for the Pharisees, for all of their devotion and their desire to follow Torah, heading down that trail, they began to lose the plot line, right? They began to lose sight of God's original intent, of the true meaning, of the deeper heart, which is why really Jesus then goes up on the mountainside, pouring out his heart and mind. And again, from 2 weeks ago, verse 20, he says, we read, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law," so we can think Torah teachers, mainly scribes. Scribes were the Pharisees, mostly were Pharisees. He says, "You will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Now again, and I think this is so important, that when it speaks of surpassing the Pharisees, Jesus is not saying you need to do better. This is not about doing better. This is about doing different. And it's so important. You can go back and listen to last week. We touched on that maybe a little bit more there. But this idea of surpassing the Pharisees is not that we do what they're doing and do it better than them. It's about doing it different from. As the scholar R.T. France, he says, Jesus is not talking about beating the scribes and Pharisees at their own game, but about a different level or concept of righteousness altogether. Which is why then he goes on, and really from verse 21 to the end of chapter 5, from verse 21 all the way to the end of chapter 5, he is giving these examples, six examples to be exact, of what that different looks like. He begins here today, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment." So Jesus begins, right? He takes us back to the Torah, back up on Mount Sinai, two stone tablets, the 10 words, the sixth commandment, Exodus 20 and 13, where it says simply, "You shall not murder." And then he follows that up. He combines that with Numbers 35 and 31, "Do not accept a ransom for the life of a murderer who deserves to die. They are to be put to death." Now, in Hebrew, there are a number of different words. Most languages, this would be true. In Hebrew, there are a number of different words for killing. The one here in Exodus, it is ratzah, which makes the translation murder accurate. It's probably the most accurate translation. And more specifically, it conveys this unlawful, intentional, malicious act. So Jesus begins, he says in effect, "You shall not do that, and anyone who does will be subject to judgment." But, verse 22, "I tell you," right? And so he's kind of like, "But I tell you," which is kind of like, listen up, pay attention, because I'm going to show you here, I'm going to show you God's heart behind this law. I'm going to show you the God's heart behind, and I'm going to reorient you, in effect. I'm going to reorient you to what God, to God's heart. "But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment." Judgment here in the Greek is from krisis, and it's the exact same word that's used for the judgment in murder as it is to the judgment here for anger, right? I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or a sister will be subject to judgment, the same judgment as for murder. Point being, in effect, Jesus says, look, yes, here's the deal. Do not murder. Absolutely fantastic, right? We're all on the same page there, right? But he says, don't make any mistake here. The heart of God, his original intent goes much deeper than is there a dead body, right? God is after so much more. And we see that deeper heart if we actually go back to the Torah, the written Torah, Genesis 1 and 27, right? Our very creation, God says, made in his image, Imago Dei, created in his image. The second parsha, we see God's heart. Again, reorientedness, right? Genesis 9 and verse 6, whoever sheds human blood by humans, shall their blood be shed for, and then here it is, for in the image of God, right? Imago Dei, has God made humankind. Right, all of humanity, every person, each one of you made in the image of God. You are an image bearer of the living God. Even the ones you don't get along with, image bearers of the living God. Even the ones that maybe you're angry at, image bearers of the living God. Right, those with whom you disagree, God's heart is more than is there a dead body. Right, don't murder, absolutely 100%. But he wants us to see that all are image bearers of the living God. So yes, don't murder, but also he says don't get angry, because either way you will be subject to Croesus. Now, really important here also regarding anger, there are different words for anger, a couple of Greek words I want to draw out here today just for a moment for context. The first word is thumos. It's not the word that's used here, but it is anger. It's that kind of, think of an outburst of passion. Think of a personal venting, kind of when you get heated up. It's described as being like the flame which comes from dried straw. So it's that kind of anger that quickly flames up and it quickly goes down, it quickly dissipates. This may not always be the case, but I think of like where somebody maybe cuts you off in traffic and your adrenaline goes and you have this rush, and then hopefully you take a deep breath and it's like not really that big a deal, and right, and it just kind of dies back down. In contrast, here is orge. Orge is that kind of anger that is deep-seated, that is long-lived. It's described as the anger that is worn like a blanket. It's this idea of nursing a grudge or holding on to a resentment. It's orge that James chapter 1 and verse 20 says does not produce, interesting here, does not produce the righteousness, right? And it's interesting in light of this whole text about the righteousness of the Pharisees, does not produce the righteousness that God desires. Meaning orge is more like a disposition. In the words of author Dallas Willard, it's like a smoldering cauldron of anger living just beneath the surface. Point being, God's heart here, it's yes, don't murder, but it's about more than is there a dead body. Right, his heart is that we would see all people as image bearers of the living God. That we would recognize and appreciate, right, kind of the sacred value of others. That we would regard others as having worth and significance. And with that, he in essence has this kind of deep-seated anger. It's toxic, not only to yourself, but then it leaks out. It leaks out to those around you, which is why he goes on here, I think, then offering a couple of instances, familiar in that day perhaps, kind of words that are maybe spoken out of that place. Again, anyone who says to his brother or sister, to a brother or sister, rakah, is answerable to the court, rakah from the Aramaic, It is described as an untranslatable word, mostly because it is like a tone of voice. It's been described as the sound you make when you clear your throat to spit on someone. That is rakah. He goes on, continues on, anyone who says you fool will be in danger of the fire of hell. The word fool here comes from moros. Moros, it's where we get the word moron, conveys really the complete and total disregard of another. And so we kind of get this idea here, right? Jesus, he starts out saying murder, and you're subject to judgment, right? But not only murder, if you carry orge, right, this deep-seated kind of anger that is toxic and kind of leaks out, you're also subject to judgment, he says. He goes on to say rakah, right? If you verbally spit in someone's face, you're answerable to the court. And if you moros, right, if you say you fool, if you disregard another, well then, you're in danger of the fire of hell. Now, I would say this is not an ancient guide to sentencing. That is not the point here. The point is not from this offense, right? We get judgment, this offense gets you to court, and this one gets you straight to hell. The point here is more that anger that is not dealt with, in the words of author Tim Suttle, will put you on a trajectory like an escalating crescendo. Will put you on a trajectory like an escalating crescendo of death. And before you know it, you're cut off from yourself. You don't even know who you are. Cut off from your community. They can't trust you. And finally, you cut yourself off from God, which is hell. Right, again, the point being here, more than don't murder somebody, it's about more than is there a dead body, right? He's reorienting us, right? Every person bears the image of God. Every person has value and has worth. Every person matters, right? And so the way that we do life and relationships, right, that matters. The way we talk to one another, that matters. The words we use and don't use, that matters. Which is why then I think he moves on. He gives us two kinds of stories, parables, two illustrations. Verse 23, he says, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled. Then come and offer your gift. Verse 25, settle matters quickly with your adversary. Right? Do it while you're still together on the way, or you may be handed over. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. And so we have two sorts of illustrations. I think both making a similar point. Again, kind of following the storyline, right? You've been doing life and stuff has happened and you start feeling upset, and then that anger it seeps in a little bit deeper, right? And it moves into a grudge and maybe I'm holding on to this resentment and it settles into my heart and mind, and God says, You want things with me? Well, then first go and be reconciled, right? That idea of reconciliation here means to restore to favorable or friendly relations, right? In the same way, right, settle matters quickly. That literally means to make friends quickly. The scholar William Barclay, he sums it up like this. He says, Jesus is quite clear about this basic fact. We cannot be right with God until we are right with one another. We cannot hope for forgiveness until we have confessed our sin, not only to God, but also to others, and until we have done our best to remove the practical consequences of it. We sometimes wonder why there is a barrier between us and God. We sometimes wonder why our prayers seem unavailing. The reason may well be that we ourselves have erected that barrier, through being at variance with our neighbors, or because we have wronged someone and have done nothing to put things right. Right, God's heart is absolutely more than simply, is there a dead body? right? His heart is that we would see people as image bearers of the living God. That we would recognize and appreciate, right, that the sacred value of the other, of each other. That we would seek and find the deep worth and significance of every other. Right, as image bearers of the living God. And so I'd like to invite us to sit for just a little bit and to consider and to think and to process. Right? And maybe ask ourselves, what place does anger have in my life and relationships? What place does anger have? Right? Be it thumos, right? Quickly erupting and then dying down, be it orge, deep seated, right? Am I nursing a grudge? Do I have resentments or a resentment? Right? What place does anger have? Right? We can, in a sense, we can just pause and reflect and kind of take inventory. Think about our relationships. Think about conditions and situations and circumstances. Right? Think about our interactions and our connections. What place does anger have in my life and relationships? With that, we could ask, how is it manifesting? How is it leaking out? Right? Sarcasm, gossip, saying stuff behind another's back. With that, we could ask, what words, both silent and audible, do I speak to others? Right? And we can think here, tone of voice, right? The clearing of your throat, right? Disregard. What words, both silent and audible, do I speak to others? And then with that, and we'll sit in stillness together, and then Dan and Carol will come up and close. But with whom is God calling you to become reconciled? With whom is God calling you to become reconciled? What relationship is it time to restore to favorable conditions? You could ask, with whom do you need to make friends quickly? With whom do you need to make friends quickly? Right, God's heart is more than, is there a dead body? It's more than simply don't murder, right? But the ways that we do life and relationships, that matters. The way we interact with one another, the way we speak to one another matters. And I think above all else, he invites us to see all others as image bearers of the living God. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you.